By 2011, Tor Eklund's life was, to put it mildly, a mess. As a young 20-something, he dreamt of making it big in showbiz, but at 32 years old, after a long stint as a production manager in New York on Broadway, the glamour of theater had lost its luster.
And I was trying to sell out, right? And because I was like, what can I do? When at that point in your life, when you know you're like, I need to make money and I need to survive and I need to have a future.
Disillusioned, Tor traded the drama of Shakespeare for the steady paycheck of a junior associate in a big New York City corporate law firm specializing in commercial and securities litigation. On the outside, he might have looked like a success, but inside, he was anything but.
You know, I lasted about 5 years there. I'm glad I did it. I learned a lot, but it made me an alcoholic. It was miserable. I've never been so unhappy.
Tor decided to quit his job and become a criminal defense lawyer, which he found to be a bit more exciting than dealing with securities. The only problem was that he had absolutely no experience in criminal law and couldn't get any clients. So, as he was turning 40, Tor's life was basically falling apart. He was broke, an alcoholic, and his marriage was rapidly deteriorating. But sometimes, when you're at your lowest point, life has a way of throwing you a curveball.
And that was right about the time Occupy Wall Street was happening. And my wife at the time was starting her photojournalist career, and she's since become very successful. You know, front page New York Times, she shoots all over the world. But she was just starting out, so she was shooting Occupy Wall Street because her photojournalist style is like anthropological. And one of the ways that she gets her shots is she spends a lot of time just like talking to people and getting to know them. So she gets access, like really close access. So there's this guy at Occupy Wall Street holding a sign that says, Zionist pigs will kill us all.
Hi, I'm Ryan Levy. Welcome to Cyberism's Malicious Life. The guy with the sign was Andrew Allen Escher Orenheimer, better known as Weave. He was born in 1985 in Arkansas. His parents describe him as an unusually bright kid. When he was just 14 years old, Andrew enrolled at James Madison University to study mathematics, although he dropped out after 2 years to focus on his real passion, computers. Even as a kid, Andrew had a special talent for pissing off everyone around him. Years later, in an interview for a podcast aptly named Offensive, he recalled a story from when he was only 10 years old. Quote, "I liked to play MUDs when I was a kid. These are like ancient text-based role-playing games. I found this MUD that had an integer underflow in the character creation process, where you could type -1, and that specific statistic would be 255. I made a script to create a character. This super overpowered character that could kill everybody in the game. I killed the entire player base of this MUD. It was fun to, like, totally ruin this game." End quote. It was a pattern that would repeat throughout Andrew's life. Boundless intelligence paired with an insatiable urge to provoke. As he carved out his online persona, Andrew chose the handle Evil Weevil. He later shortened it to Weave, not for simplicity, but because it made it easier to climb to the top of Google search results. If Andrew was going to provoke the world, he wanted to make sure everyone could find him. And provoke he did. On his blog and across various online forums, Weave became notorious for his inflammatory extremist rhetoric. In one post from 2008, he wrote, quote, For evolution to work, we must remove unfit specimens from the breeding pool. The physically unfit by birth should be exterminated in infancy. The physically unfit by accident and mentally unfit should not be supported by the state, forcing them to find a sustainable and simple way of life. End quote. For most people, views like this would spark universal condemnation. For Weave, they were just another way to rile people up. He didn't seem to care whether people admired him or hated him. What mattered was that they noticed him. And by 2007, the public began to take notice. That year, Weave was involved in one of the internet's earliest high-profile cyberbullying incidents. The target was Kathy Sierra, a 57-year-old blogger and programming instructor. Kathy had angered trolls when she urged bloggers to moderate reader comments to create healthier, less toxic online spaces. To Weave, that was a declaration of war. He retaliated viciously. Weave posted Kathy's home address and social security number online and fabricated claims that she was a former prostitute. He encouraged other trolls to join in, flooding Kathy with a torrent of harassment. She became a target for identity theft, and the rape and death threats came by the hundreds. The onslaught was so relentless, Kathy Sierra felt she had no choice but to withdraw from public life. She stopped blogging, canceled her speaking engagements, and disappeared from the internet for some 6 years. It was Weave's first brush with infamy and a preview of the chaos he would go on to unleash. Somewhere along the way, he stumbled across a group that perfectly aligned with his ethos of provocation, the Gay Nigger Association of America, or GNAA. Its members took their cues from a 1992 Danish satirical sci-fi film about intergalactic homosexual black men from the planet Anus, a setup as absurd as their own antics. GNAA's trolling campaigns spared no one. They spammed blogs, created shock sites filled with malware, and defaced Barack Obama's campaign website. After Hurricane Sandy, they spread fake news to sow panic and confusion. The more chaos they caused, the more they reveled in it. For Weave, discovering the GNAA was a revelation. The level of dedication applied to causing shit on the internet, it was mind-blowing, he later recalled. I was like, holy shit. It wasn't long before Weave became a full-fledged member of the group and eventually its president. With a few like-minded members of the GNAA, Weave co-founded a security research group with a name as infamous as its trolling roots, Goatsy Security. The name referenced a notorious obscene internet image, and the group's motto, Gaping Holes Exposed, was equal parts juvenile humor and a mission statement. Weave doesn't consider himself a highly sophisticated hacker, though. By his own admission, quote, 70% of things that I've done that have hit internationally syndicated press, I did with bash scripts that were so poorly written they would make any decent programmer cringe, end quote. What Weave lacked in finesse, though, he made up for with knowledge and dogged persistence. In 2010, Goatsy Security made waves by uncovering a flaw in Firefox that left the browser susceptible to cross-site scripting attacks, and a similar one in Apple's Safari. The group's discoveries straddled a strange line between genuine security research and the trolling chaos Weave thrived on. In early 2010, Apple unveiled a game changer, the iPad. Sleek, powerful, and futuristic, it quickly became a must-have gadget. But to truly unleash its potential, users needed internet connectivity. Apple partnered with AT&T to offer an unlimited 3G data plan for $30 a month, a deal too good to pass up for many early adopters. Among those eyeing the new device was Daniel Spittler, a member of Goatsy Security. There was just one problem. Spittler couldn't afford an iPad. Still, that didn't stop him from trying to take advantage of AT&T's tempting data plan. He purchased a SIM card similar to the ones used in iPads and inserted it into another device, hoping to trick AT&T into granting him access. But AT&T's system wasn't so easily fooled. The SIM card required registration through an actual iPad before the network would activate the plan. Determined to find a workaround, Spittler began poking around the iPad's operating system, trying to reverse engineer the registration process. He discovered that during registration, the iPad contacted AT&T's servers through a specific URL containing a unique identifier called an ICC ID, or Integrated Circuit Card Identifier. The ICC ID was tied to the SIM card, and each one was unique. Spittler experimented, sending a request to AT&T's servers with his ICC ID. At first, nothing happened, but then he realized the servers weren't responding because his request didn't appear to be coming from an iPad. By spoofing the user agent field of his request to make it look like it originated from an iPad, he succeeded. AT&T activated the plan. While testing the process, Spittler noticed something curious. AT&T's system was designed to autofill the login form with the user's email, which was tied to their unique ICC ID. So when he queried AT&T's servers with his ICC ID, they sent back his email address. That's when Spittler had an idea. If the servers responded with an email for one ICC ID, what would happen if he incremented the ICC ID and sent another request? He wrote a script called Account Slurper to automate the process, and within hours he had collected 114,000 email addresses. This wasn't just any collection of email addresses. It was a who's and who's of high-profile iPad users, media executives, politicians, celebrities. The list included New York Times CEO Jeanette Robinson, ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer, and even New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Spittler shared his findings with his GOATSE security peers, including Weave. Ever the showman, Weave saw an opportunity for maximum impact. While Spittler had done the technical legwork, Weave took charge of publicity. He crafted an email to several journalists using their own exposed email address to grab their attention. The subject line? Hi, I stole your email from AT&T. Want to know how? Gawker broke the story in June 2010 with the headline Apple's Worst Security Breach, 114,000 iPad Owners Exposed. The article was a bombshell, embarrassing both AT&T and Apple. AT&T, already notorious for poor service, was now publicly humiliated for exposing its most valuable customers. But the celebration at GOATSE Security didn't last long. A few weeks later, the FBI raided Weave's home in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and arrested him. After struggling to scrape together enough bail, Weave was eventually released from custody. But the challenges didn't end there. With no job and no steady income, he couldn't afford an attorney to represent him in the case. He had been assigned a federal defender who urged him to accept a plea bargain. In fact, Daniel Spittler, his accomplice, agreed to such a deal and was sentenced to 12 months in prison. The prosecution in Weave's case was asking for the maximum prison term under the law, 5 years. But Weave had no intention of signing any deals. He wrote the following in his blog, quote, "After meeting with upwards of 100 attorneys, I had resigned myself to running my case representing myself. I had only met a single competent attorney who understood the legal issues at hand in the case. They wanted a six-figure sum to do it. After several years of non-stop federal harassment, I had not a dime to my name left. I went to Zuccotti Park and started trolling passerby with an inflammatory sign about the Zionist occupation government. As a result, I met Tor Eklund. Cyber attacks are inevitable, but every minute counts. Reverse the adversary advantage with efficiency and efficacy. Detect in 1 minute, triage in 5 minutes, and remediate in 30 minutes. This is only possible with CyberReason's malicious operation-centric approach, built with the most advanced AI and strongest layered defense, the highest-rated solution by MITRE ATT&CK. Don't accept anything less. CyberReason EPP, EDR, MDR, XDR, and SDR. Future-proofing your security operations. Visit cyberreason.com.
So my wife goes up to him and says, you know, you're not going to be really popular in this town with that kind of sign, you know.
True to form, Weave wasn't trying to be popular. He was at the Occupy Wall Street protest that day in 2011 for the sole purpose of sowing mayhem. And he was certainly successful. On his right was an Israeli man holding a sign saying, "Fuck this guy," with an arrow pointing at Weave. And on his left were two women supporting Palestine with their own sign, which said, "We'd fuck this guy."
So she starts talking to him, and the conversation turns to the fact that he's being prosecuted for computer crime, and he's going to go to trial. So she comes back home and says, "Oh, I just met this guy. He's been accused of computer crime, and he's looking for a lawyer."
Tor Googled Weave's name and quickly realized who he was dealing with. But Tor was so down on his luck, he just didn't care.
I was like, okay, yo, whatever, right? Like, I got to do something, right? Like, you're desperate. And so I go to a bar and I meet him and we start talking. And I'm like, look, man, I'll rep you, you know, for free, you know, at trial, but just understand I've never done a trial before. And he just said to me, yeah, that's okay. Tor has kept me out of jail many a time.
The Tor Weave was referring to is the Tor Network, an open source project that makes it more difficult to trace a user's internet activity. Maybe the name Tor really was the deciding factor for Weave, but maybe, just maybe, there was more to it than that. Perhaps when he first met Tor Eklund, he saw something that set the rookie lawyer apart from the typical button-up attorney. Beneath the suit, there was still a glimmer of the actor Tor had once wanted to be, a trace of the performer, the spark of mischief that had never fully faded. Just listen to the way Tor warns us not to Google the word Gotzi.
They had this security group called Gotzi. Do not Google it. G-O-A-T-S-E. You will regret it. You will not be able to unsee it. That's G-O-A-T-S-E.
The next day, Tor began to formulate his strategy for trial. At the heart of Weave's case was a law enacted in 1986 called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which prohibits unauthorized access to a protected computer. The prosecution argued that what Weave and Daniel Spittler did, incrementing ICC IDs and probing AT&T's servers, was no different than wandering through a neighborhood, trying doorknobs to see which doors had been left unlocked, and then rifling through private drawers, exposing sensitive information that was never meant to be seen. Furthermore, claimed the prosecution, AT&T's servers weren't open to just anyone. Their design required specific steps to impersonate an authorized user, such as altering the user agent field to make their requests appear as though they were coming from an iPad. In other words, this wasn't just casual browsing. It was deception, an intentional circumvention of digital safeguards. Tor built the core of Weave's defense around a simple argument. Probing public-facing URLs couldn't be considered unauthorized access. If the information was available on the open web, requiring no passwords or special permissions, how could retrieving it possibly constitute a crime?
Unauthorized access is a really vague term. Obviously, if you hack something and you break a password or you brute force a password, you get into someone's system, that's an obvious case of unauthorized access, right? But cases came up like, is it unauthorized access to violate the terms of service to a social media site? And there's this famous case called Drew, I think it's from like 2010 or 9, somewhere in there, where this woman, this mom, lies about her age to get onto MySpace. Remember MySpace, everybody? It's like a social media site. And she goes on there to harass her teenage daughter's like rival, right, who's another teenage girl. And that teenage girl commits suicide, cyberbullying. It's a case of cyberbullying. And so the federal government prosecutes under the CFAA, under this theory of unauthorized access, that because she'd lied about her age, she violated the terms of service to MySpace. And they get a misdemeanor, I think, conviction. And then Orrin Kerr comes in.
Orrin Kerr is a professor of law at UC Berkeley and is considered the top expert on computer fraud and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
And he wins under the theory that lying about your age or violating a terms of service agreement can't be unauthorized access, because then, millions and millions of Americans or people all over the world, you lie about your weight on a dating site, anything, right? Like minor fibs or stupid stuff that you think doesn't matter, all of a sudden is a felony, right? But there's all sorts of debate over what unauthorized access means. And that's what they charged Weave with. Well, then how is that any different really from a Google search, right? Like, and if that was a felony, then your grandma doing a Google search in Kansas or wherever, she's probably committing a felony. Right? Because there's no clear line there.
The trial took place in New Jersey before a jury and lasted a little more than a week, at the end of which the jury took just 2 hours to find him guilty. Tor wasn't surprised. With Weave's toxic reputation and history of trolling, Tor had never expected much sympathy from the jury.
Our plan was to win on appeal. Of course, you're going to try to win the trial, but like the conviction rate in federal criminal trials is something like 99%. So only a fool goes in thinking, betting just all on winning.
The day of the sentencing arrived, and Weave saw it as an opportunity, not for contrition, but for maximum publicity.
He looks at me and says, I want you to ask for the maximum sentence possible. And I'm like, what? He goes, I want you to ask for the maximum sentence possible. We'll get the most publicity. I'm like, okay, dude, right? And I remember when I did that with the judge, she goes, yes, I think we can do that, right?
Tor describes the tense atmosphere in the courtroom as everyone waited for the judge to deliver the sentence.
There's all sorts of people outside the courthouse, and there's cameras, and there's U.S. Marshals are the sort of security service for the U.S. courts, among other things. And usually when you go into the courthouses, they're these sort of avuncular older men and women who are, retiring. But I'm looking at the front of the courthouse, and there's these guys that are like, NFL football linebackers standing in front of the courthouse. I'm like, what the fuck is going on, right? Like, it's all this, like, it's almost like a Fellini moment, if you've ever seen any Fellini's films. And so there's all these people, and hullabaloo, and the courtroom fills up. It's like packed with Weave supporters and women. So we're sitting down and beside me, and he's got the, it was like a tablet or something that the judge let him have. So he's like live tweeting the shit. Now that I look back on it, I'm a little surprised the judge allowed that. But okay, that's what was happening. At one point, a U.S. Marshal comes up behind Weave and just says, give me your phone, you know, give me your tablet. And Weave says, no. Then the U.S. Marshal, and I'm paraphrasing, says, oh yeah, you stupid motherfucker, you want to fuck with me? And slams his face down into the table. He gets swarmed by all these linebacker NFL U.S. Marshals who've been sitting in the jury box. The entire courtroom erupts. Women are crying and screaming. He gets mobbed, and he's extending his hand with the tablet, like in front of me, right, as they're mobbing him, trying to give it to me. And I'll never forget Judge Wigginton just going, Mr. Eklund, could you please take Mr. Arnheimer's phone? I'm like, sure, I take it. And they swarm him, they grab him. And as he's walking out, he yells, Hail Eris, which is the, I guess, Greek god of chaos. And they march him to the back holding cell. And he comes back out a few minutes later in, you know, the orange jumpsuit, shackled, you know, by his ankle, shackled by his hands. And then she gave him 3.5 years.
As Weave was led away to serve his 3.5 year sentence, the task of freeing him fell squarely on the shoulders of Tor Eklund, his inexperienced lawyer. With public hatred for his client running high, the odds didn't look promising. But then, an unexpected break. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, longtime critics of the CFAA, had been watching the trial from a distance. Now, they decided to step into the fight, and they didn't come alone. Joining them was Orrin Kerr, the nation's foremost expert on computer crime law, and a formidable ally for the appeal. That's it for this episode. Part 2, as usual, in 2 weeks. A couple of shoutouts to our listeners. Dorota from England wrote to me to tell me that she came across Malicious Life a few years ago when she was pondering a career change to cybersecurity, and she's been hooked on the podcast ever since. Thank you so much, Dorota, and best of luck in your new career. Also, a shoutout to Dominique Cameron, a former BBC producer. Last episode, I asked for your thoughts on using AI voices as part of the podcast, and Dominique suggested that I add something like, the following is narrated by an AI, just to make sure that the listeners won't be confused and think that this is an actual historical recording of the person we're quoting. That's a great suggestion, Dominique, and I'll use it in future episodes. And while we're on the topic of AI, I'd like to ask you for your help. We have more than 250 episodes of Malicious Life, and most of them don't have a cover image. You know, the image that goes along with the episode in the podcasting apps and the website. I was thinking about creating the images myself, but then I remember that I have the artistic proficiency of a blind goat. So I'm asking you, our listeners, would you like to help us by creating cover images for past episodes of the podcast? You could use whatever tool you like, of course, including AI image generators. The only requirement is that the images be at least 1440 by 1440 pixels and have no NSFW content. To make sure that two or more listeners aren't working on the same episode, drop me a line at ran@ranlevy.com. That's ranlevi.com. And I'll tell you which episodes still need cover images. Thank you very much for your help, and I'm already curious to see what you all come up with. Malicious Life is produced by PI Media. This episode was written by me, edited by Nate Nilsson, with sound design by Shelly Guetta. Our website is malicious.life. You can follow us on Twitter at maliciouslife, or follow me at ranlevi, R-A-N-L-E-V-I. thanks to CyberReason for underwriting the podcast. Learn more at cyberreason.com. Bye-bye. CK Music.